It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellen.
Coming up on episode number 116 of Sports Day Plus. At 6:15, it is the first of my three-segment conversation with Grammy-winning musician Serge Tankian, most notably of System of a Down, about his new memoir that comes out tomorrow. And in mere seconds, a potpourri of sports stories includes the first game of the upcoming NFL season being announced. Dan Quinn is receiving criticism for a t-shirt choice. And can we please stop trying to manufacture drama with in-season tournaments? I don't care if cars are involved. I am your host, Trey Elling. You can give me a follow on Twitter at Courtesy Wave, and do the same for ESPN Austin at 1027 ESPN. I hope you had a great weekend here in Austin or elsewhere. Actually spent the weekend with my family at Hyatt Las Pines after playing a golf tournament on Friday. I play golf once a year. It is not pretty. It was maybe a little bit less ugly this year because, one, I wasn't trying to swing out of my shoes thanks to a sore back, but two, traded in golf clubs. I went from blades, which are tiny club faces, I guess. You golf people are going to be able to correct me if you need to cavity backs with a huge face. So there's a lot of room for error. The ball doesn't go as far, but it's more likely to get up in the air, and I had more fun as a result. So if you haven't been out to Las Pines before, it's not cheap, but if you can afford it or maybe you can save up for something like that, take the family out there. It is a lot of fun, especially during swim season. Got a great swimming pool, really cool slide, a good lazy river as well, and it was a lot of fun for the entire family. So kudos to the Hyatt Las Pines people for continuing a great thing. As for what's going on in sports right now, a quick look around shows that we now know that Thursday night debut for the National Football League, that being the Thursday after Labor Day here in a handful of months in early September. And that would be your defending Super Bowl champ, Kansas City Chiefs. I feel like they play in this game most years, this Thursday night season kickoff. And this year's opponent is the Baltimore Ravens. You get Chiefs, you get Ravens, and it's a great matchup. It is going to be at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City. And this is a rematch of that AFC Championship game. A lot of bad blood entering that game. It wasn't a very exciting game if we were able to think back just a few months. The Chiefs do win it 17-10 before ultimately winning over the San Francisco 49ers to capture another Super Bowl title for Pat Mahomes, Andy Reid and company. And this is more of a reminder than anything else that football is not too far away, thankfully. We're not even technically to summer just yet. You can argue that occurs at Memorial Day or maybe the week after Memorial Day. I know technically the calendar summer begins in mid to late June, but learning when games are happening does feel like, at least for a moment, that the process is being sped up just a little bit. You betting against the Chiefs this year? I'm not. It's going to be hard to bet against them most years going forward until we're given a reason not to. That defense remains fairly intact, although they did trade Snead away. But to add Xavier Worthy to that offense, to give Pat Mahomes another legitimate receiving threat, and a guy who can do a lot of different things, too. It just seems like that offense is going to get back to snuff to go along with the defense. That was a big reason why they were able to make that run last year like they were. Speaking of NFL teams with Native American mascots, or perhaps franchises that used to have Native American mascots, you see the picture of Dan Quinn from over the weekend, former Dallas Cowboys DC, now the head coach with the Washington Commanders, speaking to the media from minicamp on Saturday, wore a t-shirt that has the golden red W for the Washington Commanders with the word Commanders below that, but attached to the left side of the W, the left side when you're facing Dan Quinn, are the two feathers that are recognizable as the feathers that the former Redskin mascot was donning on the back of his head prior to the team changing mascots a few years ago. And some people ended up in arms as a result, saying it was insensitive, saying how dare they, wondering if the Commanders were trying to float something to see just how accepting the public would be to return to that former mascot name. That's not how I see it, though. I don't think that's happening. I think that would be a bad move by the new ownership group, which, of course, is led by John Harris. And they don't have any desire to do that. But it is okay to tie the past to the present in a way that isn't all that offensive. Are the feathers that offensive to you? Are they? Are they offensive to you? Are they offensive to you because you think they might be offensive to somebody else? Because maybe go and ask that somebody else first before you feign offense. Now, Washington, the organization that is, did say that this is not an official t-shirt in any capacity. Dan Quinn did this on his own. Apparently, he went and bought it on Etsy or somewhere else online. And Dan Quinn himself said that the shirt was an effort to reconnect with franchise legends of the past that were alienated by the colossal POS, Dan Snyder, former owner of the team, a guy who is thankfully no longer a part of football. And if that's the rationale, it's hard to be mad at that. I dig it. Dan Quinn is a player's coach. They've got some other shirts that should probably be considered a little bit more offensive than the W with a couple of feathers hanging off of it. Just because it invokes cuss words. I know. I don't care about the cuss words, you understand. Other people do. But some of his assistants were wearing coaches that on the back said, doing hard S word with good people. And it's got the W logo before that on the back of the shirt. Got to come up with catchphrases. You got to come up with slogans. Yes, t-shirt slogans when it comes to bringing a team together. And Dan Snyder is not doing that. Dan Quinn is doing that, though, with those shirts. And I think in a roundabout way with the Washington Commanders shirt that invokes the two feathers from the previous logo. And you can bet that wherever that shirt is being sold, those things are going like hotcakes right now, if not sold out altogether. All right, real quick before the commercial break, you see more leagues considering the in-season tournament bit. I think it was started by soccer overseas. The NBA did it this last year. It was met with a pretty tepid response. The NBA swears that it's going to keep doing this, and they are. They're going to force it down our throats. But NASCAR is apparently now getting into this game. NASCAR is going to debut a 5-race in-season tournament with a $1 million prize in 2025. The format, which was announced earlier today, will have the top 32 drivers placed in an NCAA tournament-esque bracket in which the head-to-head results of each matchup will determine who advances to the next round in the following race. Seeding will be based on the highest result of each driver over the 3 races preceding the tournament. Ties will be broken by their second best finish, then by their spot in the season standings. It's very simple, and I know that this is falling on deaf ears, at least deaf ears as it pertains to those who make decisions in professional sports. In-season tournaments are not necessary. You are trying too hard. Maybe NASCAR fans are gullible enough here. But ultimately, the fans and perhaps those that it matters most to, the people involved in the tournament itself, they don't care enough, and they're not going to care enough either. All right, that is it for the sports talk today. That's because coming up, I have a 3-segment conversation with Serge Tankian, lead singer of System of a Down, and a whole lot more. He's got a new memoir coming out tomorrow called Down with the System. We're going to talk about that coming up next on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Serge Tankian is an Armenian writer, painter, activist, and Grammy-winning musician, best known for his work as the lyricist and frontman for System of a Down. But you certainly shouldn't sleep on his solo or film scoring material either. And he's sharing his story and philosophies of his unique life in his first book titled Down with the System, a memoir of sorts. I had the honor of speaking with Serge for a little bit more than 45 minutes last week. I'm going to warn you, there are parts of this conversation that were too political to play on the ESPN Austin airwaves. But you can check out this entire conversation at my podcast, Books on Pod. Find it through booksonpod.com or search Books on Pod with Trey Elling wherever you listen to podcasts. And it is my pleasure now to speak with Serge, who is not just the lead singer of one of my favorite bands, but also a fellow Armenian. Serge, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Good, Trey. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, thank you. It was so interesting to learn about your musical journey in this book, Serge. You really didn't find that passion for music until after you had graduated college. You'd been working for your uncle's jewelry company for a couple of years, developed a software that would actually really benefit you after you started pursuing music. But was there some sort of epiphany or moment that led you to understanding that your passion was the pursuit of music and ultimately deciding to do so?
Absolutely. I describe it in detail in the book. I was working at my uncle's place in downtown Los Angeles, the jewelry district. And I gathered that this was not going to be a long-term career for me because my heart wasn't into it, even though I was very involved and in the business. So I thought to myself, maybe I'll be a lawyer. You know, my parents were undergoing a huge civil lawsuit at the time, and I was doing a lot of the translating and explaining and, you know, kind of dealing with lawyers. So I'm like, I'm in the middle of it anyway. I'm, you know, reading all these briefs and learning about law firsthand, unfortunately. So I might as well be a lawyer. So I signed up for these lessons where you go and learn how to take the LSAT, which is the test that you take to go to law school. And after a long day of work, I drove my Jeep Wrangler at the time to Long Beach to take one of these classes. And, you know, I was in a big class of a lot of excited young people that wanted to be lawyers, that loved the law, and they were happy to be there. And I was miserable. Like, I hated it. I hated lawyers. I hated what was happening to my family with the lawsuit and all that. And I just, on the way back home, it was just like, what am I doing? Like, I'm going to the far reaches of who I should not be. And then an epiphany came, and I'm like, that, I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to be a musician. You know, I had to push myself to the far reaches of who I'm not, to admit to myself who I am. And the reason for that is music is a very, you know, it's not one that can guarantee success, you know, as far as income. And at the time, I was helping support my family, my parents, who had pretty much lost everything. So it was a major dive, you know. But once I realized that that was my calling, then I pivoted my life and created a bridge for myself by starting a software company so I could be my own boss and have my own hours and, you know, enhance my art and music. So it was a long road even then, but eventually got there.
By the same token, you joined a band called Soil, where you guys obviously don't make it more than a couple of years, but you do meet Darren during Soil's time as a band, and ultimately that turns into System of a Down. As System was starting to experience some mild success in the mid-1990s, you were also running a very successful software company, and it led to another crossroads moment for you. How was your dad really helpful with some invaluable advice right here to help you understand how to move forward with things?
So my dad sang and played music when he was young, but his dad died when he was in second grade. So he had to kind of get out, leave school in second grade and start working. And he was never able to pursue his musical passions. And so at one point while running the software company, I had a conundrum because it started doing well and it was taking more of my time, therefore less time to do music. Now my own company became my enemy in terms of doing music. So he saw me grappling with that conundrum one day, And he asked what's going on, and I told him. And at the time he was working, he had lost his company, he had lost, you know, pretty much everything. We had real estate and many things. And he was working for a company, and he said, "Son, I had to give up on my dream to do music. I don't want you to do the same. If I have to get a second job, we'll make it work. Just go for it," you know? And that meant a lot to me. It gave me a lot of wind in my sails, and I couldn't fail, you know? And that meant the world to me. So when he retired, and we made a record in Armenian for him, his own record, which was beautiful. It's called "Inch Pes Morananc," which means "How can we forget?" And that's the story.
And as far as system goes, you and Darren, you talk about adding a couple of guys. That, of course, does include Shavo, and then Andy, who is the original drummer, of course. And in deciding on a band name, you guys initially went with Victims of a Down, but ultimately end up changing it to System of a Down, of course, which you wholly admit in this book doesn't really mean anything. But you guys did create a sort of meaning for that phrase over time. So what does the phrase System of a Down mean to you now, Serge?
You know, it means many things to me. I mean, it's my partnership with these incredible guys that I've known for 30 years and worked with. It is a, it's been my kind of flag for anti-establishment kind of truths that I've spewed out over 30 years. It's, it is so many things. It's family, you know, it's like a home in a way, you know, that, no matter our creative differences or our vision in terms of seeing the band forward, it's home in a way.
Very cool. And it also had to have been a pretty huge honor when Rick Rubin decided that you guys were going to be the first band that he signed after moving American Recordings to Columbia. What was it like working with the legend Rick Rubin, who was already a legend by that point in time as well, much less everything he's done since then?
Yeah, Rick saw us play at the Viper Room in Hollywood, and he was laughing his ass off, which I really appreciated because it means he got the band's over-the-top kind of attitude and theatrics and all of that stuff. And I remember having a small chat afterwards outside, and I wasn't a very assertive, or I was very shy, but I said, "Would you ever consider producing us, you know, immediately?" And so we started the conversation at that time, and he ended up being our label head and producer for many years. And the relationship has been incredible. You know, I mean, it is thanks to Rick that Columbia, I think, had the wherewithal to allow us to go on tour for many years and, you know, win one fan over at a time and spend that money on tour support until they could see some revenue from actual sales and whatnot. Without someone like Rick that they would confide in, it would be hard for a young punk metal band to have that kind of support and patience from a major label, right? So there's a lot of things that Rick's kind of working with us helped, and his production, of course. Like, his ideas are usually just get to the essence of a song, find the strengths of a song, and try to, you know, multiply that strength, you know. Just an amazing person. Yeah,
I don't know if you've read his book that came out last year, but I've read that.
Yes.
And I see some of the same creative philosophies that that you expressed in your book that he expressed in that one as well, with regards to the there being a creative in all of us and really letting the creativity come to you at times versus trying to force it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love his book. I love being able to read like 10 words and then just sit with it, because it's like written like that, like a philosophy book with minimalism at heart, and just really powerful, you know, powerful statements. We've talked about it. I was just recently on his podcast, Tetragrammaton, that's coming out soon as well. He's so curious as a person. Like, he loves to learn things every day, Something new every day, and get deep into it. I mean, that's why he started the podcast.
Yeah, definitely. And had to have been pretty cool smoking a J with Tom Petty in his place at one point as well. People are just going to have to read the book to hear any more about that one. The self-titled album comes out in 1998. Toxicity comes out in 2001. In between then, you actually visit Armenia for the very first time in 2000. How did that trip change you, Serge?
It was my first trip to Armenia, and I, you know, had all these mystical things in my mind about what Armenia meant, you know, based on our grandparents' story. But modern day Armenia was different, you know, post-Soviet, and they were still grappling with some of the heavy kind of corruption and you know, some of the things that the Soviet legacy left them. But nonetheless, it was beautiful. And I got to go to Nagorno-Karabakh, which we call Artsakh in Armenian, for the first time then as well. And I was just amazed by the countryside, by the people. I felt, you know, at the time, nobody really knew who I was because the band was still very young. So it was kind of, I went around very freely and enjoyed the country, went to the sites, saw Gerard, the monastery, and Garni, the ancient temple, and just really took in the sights. And it had, for a place that you had never been to in your life, it had this incredible draw on me. When I landed back in LA, I felt like I was in a foreign land, even though I spent the majority of my life in Los Angeles. And it just felt really incredible that you could go somewhere like that, that you had never been to, and had this incredible connection to it that you would have never thought of, you know?
He is Serge Tankian, lead singer of System of a Down and a whole lot more. He's got a new book out tomorrow called Down with the System. Coming up, we continue our conversation here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie.
Back for segment 2 of 3 with Serge Tankian. He is a Grammy-winning musician whose work includes serving as lead singer of System of a Down. He's done a whole lot more, though. That includes solo work. He has scored for films, TV shows, also theatrical productions at times. And he's telling his story in the excellent new memoir called Down with the System. Comes out tomorrow wherever books are sold. Missed any part of this conversation? Want to go back and listen to the entire thing? Uncensored, uncut. You can do so through my podcast, Books on Pod. Just search booksonpod.com. That's the website. Or booksonpod.com with Trey Elling. You can type that in wherever you listen to podcasts. And Serge, it was surprising to be reminded that the album Toxicity hit number one on September 11, 2001, especially considering what transpired with you personally after that. You wrote an essay just days after September 11th that was highly critical of the U.S. and their role in what ultimately happened on September 11th, and received a ton of backlash as a result of that. And you admit in writing in the book, I don't think that I'd ever felt more like a man without a country than in the days, weeks, and months after 9/11. When did that change for you, if at all, to where it did feel more like your country?
I mean, it felt like my country from a long time back. You know, it's just when you're in a democracy and you are afraid to speak the truth because of backlash, that's when you feel, you know, that's when you feel like that something's really wrong, right? And mind you, that coupled with growing up as an Armenian American in Los Angeles, paying taxes to a country that is not properly recognizing the genocide of our ancestors, a democracy not recognizing the proper history because of political expediency, because of Turkey being a NATO ally and they didn't want to recognize it, you know, just dirty political geopolitics. That makes you an activist. You know, that made me an activist. It made me someone who fights for truth and justice, not just having to do with, you know, Armenians or Armenian issues, but many issues, you know, in the US, human rights issues around the world, and even animal rights, climate issues. You see the world of injustice. You see that imbalance, and you want to kind of tip the scales up. because you know that that's going to make a world a better place in every way. And so, you know, I've always spoken truth to power, but only because I cared. If I didn't care, I wouldn't speak my mind, right? So that's what people, but unfortunately, because I wasn't born here, I got some after 9/11 for speaking truth to power.
Yeah, and look, it's hard to go against a public narrative, to speak what you believe to be the truth. It takes conviction to do that, and it also takes an understanding that you are going to face an enormous backlash potentially in return, too. I don't know how much top of mind that was for you versus the raw emotion of everything that had just happened and what transpired leading up to that as well.
Now, that's the word. That's a good word, public narrative. Whenever what you say, whenever the truth matches the public narrative, it's easy to speak the truth. For example, when George W. became unpopular years later, all musicians, all artists were bagging on him. And I'm like, where the f*** were you when, you know, this is what we, you know, there was a handful of artists that had the courage to, you know, and to question his invasion of Iraq or all of the things that they did using 9/11 as a, you know, platform, as a springboard, really.
Wars, the Patriot Act, there are all sorts of ways they exploited that, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's one thing that it's really hard when the public narrative is against what you're saying, and yet you still have to speak the truth. And it's actually more important then to actually tell the truth than it is in any other case.
Completely agreed with that. Now, I love the stories of how toxicity and chop suey came to be. I'm not going to have you retell those right here. People just need to buy the book to learn about those. As far as chop suey is concerned, though, it was nominated for a Grammy in 2002. I'd forgotten that. You guys were actually invited to perform at the Grammys that year, but you and Darren decided not to. You say that looking back now, you'd tell your younger self to just go play the damn show. Why is that?
I don't know. For us, it felt like we didn't want or need someone else to pat us on the back and say, you're doing good kind of thing. It just felt very anti-punk rock, to be honest. And so it was a bit of a you know, kind of thing, you know, and we didn't get the Grammy for it, which is fine. We got a Grammy for BYOB a few years later and we still didn't end up going or playing, to be honest. But in retrospect, the music industry is not that big of an industry. And touring with all these different bands, and, you know, everyone goes to these events and you see people and you have a beer with them and you actually have a good time. And so that's what I meant. In retrospect, it would have been a fun time. Like, who cares, you know, win or lose. Like, so, yeah, that's what I meant.
Well, it is interesting that you guys won a Grammy a couple years later, because I double checked this too with the digital copy. You mentioned it once and it was mentioned very fleetingly. And even the song itself, BYOB, was given just a paragraph or two. Does that Grammy really mean anything to you, Serge, in the end?
I mean, awards are nice for a cabinet somewhere in the house, but it doesn't mean, I mean, it's nice. It's always nice when people like what you do. It's human to want that, you know, like, be appreciated. That's cool. But does it mean anything? I mean, really? Nah.
So the Grammy's like a youth soccer trophy, just in a cabinet somewhere in your house.
It is. I've put it between my favorite books in book cabinet.
Okay.
So it's holding two sides of really great books.
I think that's a great place for a Grammy.
It's holding the books, and it, so it's also utilitarian, right? It's not just symbolic. It's also, but my son the other day asked, wow, Dad, you've got all those awards. And he pointed to the Grammy. He goes, what's that one? And I said, that's called a Grammy. And he goes, okay, and what's this one? I said, that's called a this. Like, and it was just interesting just watching him. And he said, do you have more awards? I'm like, yeah, probably in some boxes somewhere. He goes, wow, you have a lot of awards. I'm like, yeah, but I also have a lot of guitars. And those I can play.
Well, I've had to tell my kids, because we do play youth sports, and there have been a couple of seasons that they've lost in a championship game, and they're so upset that they don't get that trophy. And I'm like, guys, understand that these trophies are little plastic relics, that you've gone through the important part. That is the process. This is getting better. That's coming together with your teammates and forming friendships. Like, you got the important part of all of this. The trophy is a byproduct of all of that, not a very necessary byproduct.
Yeah, you're like, did you have fun? Yes or no? I mean, that's what it is. You know, did you learn something? Yes or no? The rest is BS.
What does the song BYOB mean to you, though?
BYOB is a really good anti-war song, I would say, you know, but done in a humorous way. Everybody's going to the party, have a real good time, dancing in the desert, blowing up the sunshine. I mean, you know, but during the verses, you're talking about all these evil things done by governments. And in a very kind of, you know, there's certain biblical expressions, certain, you know, Iraq War memories kind of expressions and whatnot. It's a really well-crafted, I think, you know, Darren wrote the music to the song along with the chorus lyrics. And I basically wrote, a lot of other lyrics around it. And, you know, it's a strong song, I think. Yeah.
So, you also say that Steal This Album, which is a nod to the Abbie Hoffman counter culture classic, Steal This Book, which I actually have stolen a copy of Steal This Book.
Oh, wow. Look at you.
Yeah. Along with the single Boom are two of your favorite things that you've helped to create with System of a Down. Why are you so fond of those two things?
I'm fond of Steal This Album because it is our most diverse record musically. It has songs on there, you know, in totally different uniforms, like just, you know, and it's one that I wouldn't mind playing, you know, from the first to the last at a concert. Like that would be fun to do as a record, as a concert experience. And Boom is important because we put out that song with a video directed by Michael Moore right before the Iraq War. Mm. And we fought with the label to get the funding to be able to do that video because we weren't just launching it as a single. We didn't want to do a single. The record company wanted us to put a single from Steal This Album. And, you know, the songs from Toxicity were still on the radio. And we just felt like it would be, you know, not great for the band to oversaturate our music on the radio. So we said, we don't want to do a single. We want a political song and do a video for it and not have radio necessarily play it. And they're like, the f*** are you talking about? You know? And, but we fought to get that done and we did. And the video shows us in the LA protests leading up to the Iraq War, along with protests all around the world that, you know, there were 10 million or 10 million plus people protesting before a war even occurred, knowing that that's going to happen, that the US was going to attack Iraq on the fake WMD assertions and layer cake and all of that stuff. Everyone knew, people generally knew that it was bullshit. But it happened anyway in our name, you know?
Yeah. It's so difficult for artists, especially when they're new to the system, to fight for that creative freedom. But credit to you guys, you were not going to waver from your convictions. And ultimately, long-term, I think that served you very well. That just helped the overall respect that you had from the fan base. And it helped you guys to probably maintain a certain level of respect with yourselves too.
I think, you know, the message has always been important to me because I was an activist before becoming an artist, and to System in general as well, System of a Down in general. Although, you know, there have always been pushes and pulls between the music and the message within the band. The guys kind of keep me in line, not overdoing with the message, and to make sure I don't forget that we're an actual musical band. Yeah, so it's good.
He is Serge Tankian, a musician who is best known as the frontman for System of a Down. He's got a new book out tomorrow that tells his life story. It's called Down with the System. It is a great read. And coming up, we have one more segment talking about that here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie.
Back for one final segment with Serge Tankian, Grammy-winning musician who is best known as the frontman for System of a Down, but he is a whole lot more than that. Not only as a musician, he has a bunch of solo material and film scoring on his credits, but he's also a writer, a painter, an activist, and that activism does include making sure people understand that the Armenian Genocide did happen a little bit more than 100 years ago. Whether or not you realize it, I am more Armenian than anything else, so to get to have this conversation with Serge means a little bit more to me, too. And while I have had to censor parts of this conversation, not just language, but also the political tone at times, you can find the chat in its entirety through my podcast, Books on Pod. Go to that website, booksonpod.com, or search Books on Pod with Trey Elling, wherever you listen to podcasts, and it will be out tomorrow morning. And Serge, System of a Down is made up of all Armenians, but you guys have only played the country of Armenia one time. The first time, the only time, was April 23rd, 2015, during the 100th anniversary of Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. What was that like for you guys getting to play that show in those conditions?
It was the top of the mountain for System of a Down, as far as I'm concerned. It was the kind of, if there was one event that we were meant or created to play, it was that night. And it felt that way. You know, it was raining. There were about 50,000 people in Republic Square. And, you know, they say it always rains, even though it's April, it always rains for the Armenian Genocide every year in Armenia. And I remember before we went up, we huddled and we couldn't believe we were there. Like, because it wasn't just playing a show and paying homage to our people there, but it was also paying homage to the 1.5 million who were massacred during the first genocide of the 20th century. And our own grandparents in particular, and their memories and their presence was really felt that night. I felt the presence of my grandparents heavily. And, you know, it was like this juxtaposition of these worlds, physical, spiritual, emotional, history, current, like all happening at the same time. So it became this really unique, one-of-a-kind show and experience for us.
You went back to Armenia in 2017 with Anthony Bourdain. Yes, I am jealous of that for parts unknown. Was that as much fun as it sounds like it would be going someplace foreign with Bourdain?
It was, yeah. I mean, he was really kind to have reached back out when I reached out to him about going to Armenia. I kind of proposed it and worked with their producers to find the right people to talk to, restaurants to go to, that kind of stuff. And he was, I loved the fact that he was such a truth teller and so, you know, he's so punk rock. Like he was so punk rock. Like he loved music. He loved good music. He loved good food. He didn't deal with bullshit. And he spoke truth. I mean, for someone who's popular on TV, you know, talking head, to be so truthful and honest and funny and his, the way he spoke, the way he wrote, the way he writes his monologue, if you listen to Kitchen Confidential or his other books, it's remarkable. He was a remarkable writer. And so really good guy in person. We had, you know, some laughs and some nice chats because he really authentically wanted to know about Armenia and, you know, and what made it tick and what was important. I remember his producers calling before the show and saying we're having problems with CNN's lawyers because Anthony wanted to go to Nagorno-Karabakh, which was not an official country, you know, according to the UN at the time, because even though it's been Armenian lands for thousands of years, Stalin in 1920s had decided to cede that territory to Azerbaijan in the 1990s. Armenians won, you know, got their independence, an area that was majority Armenian and had held on to that until 2020 when Azerbaijan invaded again. And just last year, as you I'm sure know, it was depopulated of Armenians through ethnic cleansing by Azerbaijan, which is a major human rights catastrophe and something that needs to be taken to the International Criminal Court. But so he was going to go. And the lawyers were hesitant about it. So his producer said, can you give us some arguments why he should go? And I basically said, look, if you want to understand modern Armenia, you have to understand three or four things. One, the devolution of the Soviet Union. Two, the large earthquake in Spidak that happened in 1998 that devastated everything. And three is the war in Artsakh. You know, if you don't understand those three things, you're not going to understand what makes Armenia tick now. So that's apparently all they needed. And Tony ended up going there and You know, I was incredibly appreciative. He was on a blacklist by, he was blacklisted by Azerbaijan before his death, which really made me think. And when I remember having a conversation with him, I said, listen, if you go to Nagorno-Karabakh, I'm just giving you a heads up, you're going to get blacklisted by Azerbaijan. And I loved his response. He said something like, I'm putting it more, he said something ruffian, but I'm putting it more gently. He said something like being blacklisted by that guy or Putin or Erdogan in Turkey is a good thing. Like, you know, that kind of a thing. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. I loved seeing that. That's why I loved Tony.
Yeah. And it doesn't surprise me that he's speaking truths like that to the bitter end. All right. Last few questions now, Serge. First off, what do you love about America?
What I love about America is our enthusiasm. Enthusiasm to get things done. A feeling that anything can happen, you know? You know, we're not, because we're a younger country, I don't think we're burdened by history as much as many other European nations or countries around the world. We have this, you know, this can-do attitude. I love that. I love that about the U.S. that makes it different. And I think it makes it really desirable for people around the world.
What do you love about making music?
It saved my life. You know, making music saved my life. It started out as a meditative practice, playing keyboards, my first instrument. And now it's what I get excited to do every day, either art or music, anything within the arts. It's what keeps me going. You know, it's like if I have physical pain and something's hurting so much that like I can't deal with it and I need to think of something positive, I think of creating music. I think of, you know, literally it makes me happy. That and coffee.
And do you have an Armenian coffee company now? Did I read that correctly?
I do. Yeah, we started Kavat Coffee in 2018. Kavat means cup in Armenian. And we're about to open up a cafe gallery in Eagle Rock, California. With within the next month or so, doing the build out now, but